From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A call by the UN Special Syrian Envoy for international assistance in defending the Syrian city of Kobane against an ongoing siege by the rebel group ISIL. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The world will deeply regret the takeover of the city of Kobani in northern Syria, also known as Ain al-Arab, a senior UN envoy for the country has warned. For the past 3 weeks, the city of 400,000 inhabitants has been under siege by the Islamist militant group ISIS, also called ISIL. According to the UN Human Rights Office, the militants have intensified indiscriminate shelling in various parts of the town and have broken through trenches dug by Kurdish fighters. They've also reportedly taken control of a number of buildings. Stefan de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, says the defenders of the city need international support.
They are fighting with normal weapons, whereas the ISIS has got tanks and mortars. The international community needs to defend them. The international community cannot sustain another city falling under ISIS. Turkey has been very generous in receiving more than 200,000 of its inhabitants. But what is needed now is concrete action. The world, all of us, will regret deeply if ISIS is able to take over a city which has defended itself with courage, but is close to not be able to do so. We need to act now.
The civil war in Syria has been ongoing for the last 3 years. A number of terrorist organizations like ISIS have emerged from the conflict. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General is telling the world it's time to step up in the battle against Ebola. Stephanie Kutrix has more.
The international community should increase assistance 20-fold to fight the Ebola disease outbreak in West Africa, according to the UN Secretary General. So far, 3,865 people have died from Ebola, mainly in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Ban Ki-moon told a high-level donor conference in Washington, D.C., that West Africans are scared. He said the best antidote to fear is an effective and urgent response. He added that the situation will get worse before it gets better, but how much worse depends on the international community. He asked those who have pledged to deliver funds and those who have yet to pledge to do so soon. Meanwhile, the World Bank has approved $400 million in grants and loans for the three West African countries. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Hong Kong remains quiet, albeit with some continuing protests scattered across the city. Meanwhile, its chief executive has gone on a public relations offensive, hoping to be heard, in his own words, in a Western media environment that certainly appeared hostile from his perspective. So he did what many here in the U.S. do when we think the media is treating us unfairly. He wrote a letter to the editor. For more, we have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Liang Chongying wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times saying that any suggestion that the Chinese government is interfering in the current electoral reform debate is unfounded. Liang noted that Hong Kong's future electoral, economic and social development is a natural and legitimate concern of the Chinese central government. He emphasized that both the Joint Declaration and the Basic Law state that the winner of a chief executive election will be appointed by Beijing. And he said nobody in Hong Kong, or abroad for that matter, can ignore Beijing's legal authority. Areas of Hong Kong are still paralyzed by the protests that began on September 28th. The demonstrations have put a dent into the business of local shops and banks.
File this one under Better Late Than Never. Although it's been some 67 years since winning independence from the United Kingdom, the new Indian government is beginning a major overhaul of its laws to remove the many remaining vestiges of its colonial past. Press TV's Sanjay Sethi reports from New Delhi.
The new Modi government has identified some 287 laws dating back to the time when India was ruled by Britain. India gained independence from British rule in 1947. However, there are certain colonial laws and rules that are still being used in the country.
So you might have a law which was made in 1836, 1858, And in the last 60 years since India became independent, Indian Parliament has been amending those laws. However, the parent law stays. So when it comes to legal interpretation of a law, the bureaucracy and the judiciary has to look at the parent law.
Laws that state a motor inspector must have clean teeth, pigeon chest persons are not allowed to drive, and flying kites or balloons require police permission are still prevalent. Reluctance of the bureaucracy, disruptions in parliament, and various governments' oppositions to repealing such laws are cited as the main reasons.
I'm a school teacher and the building where I teach is 86 years old. It is frustrating sitting with lawyers, police officials, just to make changes to the garden where children can play easily.
Today, the Bharatiya Janata Party government has an absolute majority in the lower house of parliament. Amending these laws will be easier without much opposition. India ranks 134 in the ease of doing business. The new Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a pro-entrepreneur. Repealing these laws is high on his agenda. Analysts say, given the state's widespread bureaucratic corruption, removal of irrelevant and outdated laws is a welcome step towards better governance. Sanjay Sethi, Press TV, New Delhi.
It's been 5 weeks since Kim Jong-un, the head of state of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, better known in the West as North Korea, has been seen in public by Western media, creating a whirlwind of what can best be characterized as speculative gossip across the spectrum. According to the Washington Times, the leading theory among intelligence officials is that the young leader has disappeared from public view because he's bedridden with a bad case of gout brought on by heavy smoking and too much caviar. The Washington Post carried a piece by a frequent contributor, Daniel Dresner, that went so far as to suggest that Western media should float the five weirdest theories about the Korean leader, as Dresner wrote, quote, in the hope that they goad Pyongyang to shoot them down, closed quote. Among the theories he suggests publishing as a part of the public discourse are that Kim Jong-un is recovering from Ebola, contracted while assisting West African patients, and that werewolves have taken over North Korea. South Korea is one of the two most important allies of the U.S. in the Far East, one of the two legs upon which President Barack Obama's so-called pivot to Asia rests, the other being Japan. Both Asian countries are often held out by American officials as democratic models for the rest of the region and are often posited in contrast to North Korea and even China on such issues as freedom of speech and freedom of the press. But a recent indictment by South Korean authorities of a Japanese reporter over his criticism of the South Korean president has peeled back the veneer of democracy a bit, and what it revealed is not pretty. NHK's Takafumi Terui reports from Tokyo.
Tatsuya Kato is the former Seoul bureau chief of Japan's Sankei Shimbun newspaper. He wrote a commentary in August that said Park's whereabouts were unknown for 7 hours on the day the Seoul ferry sank. He wrote that there was a rumor that she was with a man. More than 300 people, mostly teenagers, died in the accident. The Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office has banned Kato from leaving the country. Prosecutors have summoned him 3 times for questioning. They say his article is not based on fact and has damaged Park's reputation. U.S. government officials say they are following the case. The State Department spokesperson says U.S. leaders support freedom of speech and expression.
We have outlined in the past about our concerns about the law on the books in South Korea.
Members of the group Reporters Without Borders have called on South Korean authorities to drop the charges. They said in a statement that it's normal for members of the media to question politicians' actions. The head of the newspaper where Kato works has demanded that the indictment be immediately retracted. Sankei Shimbun's president says Kato was writing a commentary about Park and had no intention of defaming her. Japanese officials have repeatedly asked South Korea to act prudently over the matter.
The indictment is extremely regrettable from the standpoints of freedom of speech and the relationship between Japan and South Korea. This is not how democratic countries should behave. We'll ask the South Korean government today to provide a detailed explanation and convey our concerns.
There have been some recent signs of warming in the country's relations. The Japanese and South Korean foreign ministers have sat down twice since August, after going for nearly a year without meeting. And officials have held informal talks on the possibility of a summit between Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and President Park. They had discussed arranging it as early as next month. But officials in Tokyo suggest the mood could now change because of the indictment. Takafumi Terui, NHK World, Tokyo.
South Korea isn't the only U.S. ally struggling with freedom of the press and free speech. Even Britain, the so-called mother country and home of the Magna Carta, apparently can't handle criticism of its leaders or even the threat of criticism. The Russian international news outlet, RT, has had its transport billboard ads banned by local officials and ad agencies. RT's Polly Boyko reports from London.
Well, there are over 500 of these now mysterious-looking telephone booths across London. And the ad that was originally meant to go here was for RT TV, and it had on it pictures of Western leaders, and it posed the question about what happens if there's no plurality in international media coverage. But it looks like not that many people were comfortable with that question here being asked, because major outdoor advertising platforms here have refused to put up that original poster. They have cited political undertones as the reason. Now, in an official press release, the editor-in-chief of RT, Margarita Simonyan, has said that the ad prompts the viewer to ask about what happens if there's no alternative opinion in news. And she says that it's disappointing that people are too afraid of that question even being asked. So it looks like instead of asking the question, these posters are now, they're creating intrigue instead. You can see them playing on that poster ban by saying what happens when there's no second opinion. And for the ad that we can't show, they're suggesting that you download the RT augmented reality app where you can see it and hope that it hasn't been taken down off the internet as well.
Here in the U.S., the battle over water continues in Detroit, where hundreds of thousands of people are either going without water or are facing water cutoffs for non-payment. One person who's fighting back is Pastor Ray Anderson of the House of Help Church and Community Center, who joined with a grassroots group called Water Brigade to halt the water cutoffs. Shortly after he joined, the city cut off the water supply to his own church as well. Anderson says that water is a God-given right, particularly since Detroit sits on the Great Lakes, the greatest reservoir of fresh water in the world. He vowed to continue the fight, and when speaking with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford, said it was suspicious that his water was cut off after he joined the battle.
I could assume that, but I don't want to assume it. I don't know. It's always that possibility. And it's kind of ironic because almost 2 years ago, Georgetown Law School came to Detroit, and they went to Boston to do a study concerning the indifference between African American and cities, which there's a difference when it comes to the affordability of water and sewage. And this was even before what's going on in Detroit. They came here to interview clients that we distribute food to on a weekly basis, and to come up with a bill that they presented to Congress in D.C. And the study is called Capped Out. They want to come up with an Affordable Water Act for urban America. So that happened about 2 years ago, and now what we're dealing with in Detroit concerning the water shutoffs, and me being an advocate and speaking out, you know, with the Water Brigade, and even just concerning my situation, I don't want to assume that's what happened, but it could be a possibility, and that we're still, you know, dealing with that situation now.
These prices seem exorbitant. I know people in Detroit have said, and people around the country have also remarked, that Detroit sits on the Great Lakes, the greatest reservoir of fresh water in the world.
Yes. One of the things that I know, the system has been neglected for over 100 years. They haven't did any updates or repairs, and now, and the extreme weather that we've been having over the last few years have been exposed, and they haven't put any money in the system. And then because of the fate of the city, now they have to tax the people that's here to get the money to repair a failing system, which they're taxing people that's underpaid. You know, we barely have, I think, 800,000 people here now, and the poverty rate is overwhelming, and you can't get water, squeeze water out of a turnip. It's just not there. And sadly, people have to make a choice. Those that are on a fixed income are senior citizens, between buying medication and paying this bill or paying that bill. A lot of people are losing their homes because the water bill is connected to the homes, and the home goes into foreclosure because of the water bill. So there's just so many pieces to this puzzle right now, but it's just so unfair. It's so extreme.
And some see insidious motives involved in that, a kind of plan for ethnic cleansing in Detroit, or at least an economic cleansing of Detroit, to get rid of poor people in the city.
That's what's going on. I mean, there's so much hopelessness right now. It's really sad. We need help. We need God to intervene, because when it comes to government and different entities, there's just no compassion. I mean, I believe it's a God-given right for us to have water, and it should be according to what you can afford to pay. I'm not saying it should be free. I know they have to operate the system, but it should be according to income, especially at this point, especially here in Detroit.
And yet we hear that private for-profit companies and even the state of Michigan owe millions of dollars in water bills, but they're not cut off.
No. No, and that's true. But yet they have even hired contractors right now to go throughout neighborhoods, and if you have any outstanding balance, they're cutting you off right then. Actually, CBS News came in this week from New York, and they interviewed the one lady who had called our organization for help. She's a hard-working young woman. She works two jobs and belongs to a thriving church, but yet she's been without water for a couple of months now. That's just really sad.
And here you head up a faith-based organization that's trying to help people get over the hump, including the water hump, and you get cut off.
Oh, yes. And even the circumstances right now with the building that we're in, this was a vacant school that would really, it would be blight if we weren't in here and what we're doing in the community. And I've been going back and forth with DPS concerning this building, which, here again, we're asset and serving the community. They should just give us this building, or it would be sitting here and it would be a part of the blight in the community. Yet we've used this facility to uplift and do a work in the community.
And yet Detroit is now making a big national hoopla about knocking down abandoned buildings, but it appears that their policies on water and other things are driving people out of their buildings and creating more blight.
Yes. With the situation in Detroit, there should be no homelessness. Those that are in their right mind, that are capable, could help rebuild if we would come up with some type of fair plan to rebuild communities. We could put families and single mothers with children and help rebuild communities and build, here again, a tax base. We help and work together.
But that would anchor poor people in Detroit, and some people want them gone.
Well, I pray that organizations like ours, some of the churches and pastors, would really become aware of what's going on and make a stand. I believe it's God's heart to rebuild the city.
Ambassador Rodolfo Reyes, Cuba's permanent representative to the United Nations, took his country's opportunity to address a plenary session of the UN General Assembly Wednesday to warn the nearly 200 nations represented there of several imminent dangers which threaten the actual existence of the human species. Among the items he listed were the well-known threats of nuclear weapons and climate change. But although such warnings are not uncommon, the ambassador did something that's become quite rare in recent years. He called on the member states of the assembly for actual commitments to address them.
On October 24th next year, we will celebrate the 70th anniversary of the official establishment of the United Nations organization. On this same date in 1945, the world began recovering from a bloody world war which left some 60 million people dead. That's about 2% of the global population. The 51 founding member states ushered in an era, one which was already being challenged by the destructive energy of the atomic bomb, as the inhabitants of Hiroshima and Nagasaki experienced just a few months prior. 70 years later, humanity is literally facing a life and death situation as they face serious threats. Thousands of nuclear weapons capable of extinguishing mankind and the destructive acceleration of climate change, serious and fast-spreading pandemics are threatening. There are new threats and forms of aggression against sovereignty and the self-determination of peoples. These are just some of the most serious threats here. About 7.2 billion people in the world have high hopes from the UN to give reason for their existence. Cuba agrees with the Secretary General on the priority to eliminate nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. Nothing can justify that now, 25 years later, after the end of the Cold War, humanity continues to be threatened by the existence of more than 16,000 nuclear weapons, 4,000 of which are ready for immediate use. The use of even a minimal amount of these arms would have catastrophic consequences for our planet. It is therefore important as we pass this historic step by the General Assembly to establish the 26th of September, the International Day for the Complete Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. We just recently celebrated this for the first time successfully. The only way humanity could stop suffering from this terrible impact of nuclear weapons is its prohibition and complete elimination. And the great majority of member states have proposed concluding a comprehensive convention on nuclear weapons to prohibit its possession, development, production, acquisition, testing, stockpiling, transfer, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons, and for their destruction. Therefore, we call upon the Secretary General to contribute to this effort through his influence as we start negotiations on this convention. Mr. President, climate change is clearly here, and mankind's influence in accelerating this process is also increasingly clear. The ice caps are melting on the Earth, the global temperature is rising, and the sea levels are gradually rising. There are numerous phenomena associated with this extreme climate. We are seeing the effects of acidification of seas and oceans. Global greenhouse gas emissions are empowering this warming of the planet and have contributed to this over the past 40 years. Climate change continues to be a reflection of irrational and unsustainable patterns of production and consumption, sustaining a system of economic capitalist domination that creates inequality and poverty. As we tackle climate change, we have to tackle its root causes. We must firmly tackle poverty and inequality as well. We understand that the market cannot resolve any of these problems. As the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Cuba said at the climate summit in 2014, We need clear efforts and commitments. We need real political will of governments, of industrialized states, which will share the future with the South. It is unacceptable that the Millennium Development Goals cannot be achieved when we have so many existing resources and the technological revolution. The solutions we need are being postponed, and we are wrong if we think that the United Nations, an agreement of the United Nations alone with objectives and goals for the Sustainable Development Agenda, will change these injustices, inequalities, and root causes of underdevelopment in various parts of the world. What we need, in fact, is cooperation from all United Nations member states, first and foremost from industrialized countries, in order to respond to this historic debt that they have towards people who have suffered from the colonial, neo-colonial, and unfair system of economic and financial relations in the world. We cannot achieve a new sustainable development agenda while 1% of the richest in the world has 50% of the world's wealth, while 85 persons in the world, the richest, have the same wealth as 3.57 billion inhabitants, the poorest in the world. That is half of the world population. In order to achieve a sustainable development agenda, we need to ensure adequate resources and to ensure we tackle these multidimensional poverty in the world. In addressing health, education, and living conditions, to achieve a sustainable development agenda, we cannot achieve this while 842 million people, one out of every eight inhabitants in the planet, suffer from chronic hunger, as we've seen in 2011 and 2013, or while people continue to suffer from foreign occupation, as we've seen in our sister country of Palestine. Mr. President, in order to achieve a sustainable development agenda, we would have the available resources if we reduced the military spending budget in 2013. This reached the sum of billions of dollars in order to cover implementation. The United Nations General Assembly has a responsibility to mobilize the necessary financial resources to overcome those issues, as we see in the Secretary General's report on the work of the organization. Strengthening the General Assembly and ensuring a deep-seated reform of the Security Council to ensure it is democratic, transparent, and inclusive. We must address this now. Humanity is now facing a new challenge, the impact and spread of Ebola in West Africa. These require urgent actions. Cuba responded promptly to the call of the General Director of the WHO and the Secretary General of the United Nations on that situation. We're part of the first team of the first international health team to be in Sierra Leone. The historic leader of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, said that these are the heroes of our time in an article published on October 4th. Those who manufacture lethal weapons cannot have honor. We hope that Cubans going to Africa can help this situation in a spirit of human solidarity. This is the spirit and political will required in order to overcome the challenges before us.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.